Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History Hotline. This is going to be a very special episode because I'm joined by a very special guest today. We are thinking about the theme of migration and different types of people that came from different parts of the world to this country that we call Britain, some of the challenges they might have dealt with, how they formed communities, and how they essentially navigated British society in their respective eras. And so our guest today is the wonderful Satya Gunput. And Satya is a British Mauritian PhD candidate in the field of history, of course, at Birkbeck College in part of the University of London. And his PhD is funded by the Bonnard Trust. Now, his work focuses on the history of immigration and ethnicity in post-war Britain and how that kind of interacted with government on a national and local level. It also looks at political debates surrounding multiculturalism, which I think is a key theme of his work, and also creates this kind of idea and looks at the idea of empire, the afterlife of empire in modern British history. And so Satya received his master's in historical research from Birkbeck College in 2016 after completing his bachelor's in modern history at Christchurch University of Oxford. And his broader research interests look at post-colonialism, transnationalism, and then kind of intersections between race, class, and gender. So all the things we talk about on this podcast on a regular episode, which is why he's a perfect guest. So today we're going to be thinking about, you know, some of the kind of South Asian migration and the diaspora of South Asian people, black feminist groups in Britain. And this is exactly what Satya's work looks at. He looks at mental health among Afro-Caribbean migrants in Britain. And he has written on the lived experiences of a kind of wide range of different people of colour in this country. Also a keen fencer, a fantastic fencer, and, you know, at an international level, which I just thought was so interesting when I was reading your bio. So welcome, Satya, to the History Hotline.
Thank you very much for a comprehensive introduction. I think that's the best introduction I've ever had. So,
I'm honored to have you, and I'm honored that my introductions are living up to it. So, we've got a lot of questions, I think, and a lot to talk about because, well, we're honored to have such a knowledgeable guest. You know, they're normally stuck with me, but we've got you today. So I thought we'd start with like some quick fire questions just to get to know you as a researcher, as a historian, and as a person. So don't, you know, don't panic. They're not going to be too intrusive, I hope. But they are quick, so don't think about it too long. Is that okay?
I'll be quick.
Wonderful. What is your favorite historical book or text?
I don't know if it counts as strictly historical, but I really like Policing the Crisis by Stuart Hall et al., the Birmingham Contemporary Culture Group.
Love that.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite. I don't know if it's strictly historical, but it's historical for me now, so.
Definitely. Makes sense. I love that. And then your favorite historical figure?
I once sat next to Gail Lewis at a Birkbeck function, and I didn't clock it was her until quite into the conversation. And then I thought, this is the first time I've sat next to a bona fide historical figure, someone I write about in my thesis. So I put Gail.
Defo.
And she's an Arsenal fan as well. So double points.
Oh, no. Oh, gosh. Okay. I'll give you that one, minus the Arsenal. You know, little point there. And then a bit of a strange question, but why do you like history?
I've had a really good history teacher at school. Wow. And from like like in primary school, really got into me like the storytelling aspect of it. Yeah. And as I got into like academically into history, obviously maybe the storytelling aspect becomes less important, but yeah, especially when you write on histories of race and ethnicity and people of color, yeah, actually a lot of that work is about like sometimes recovering stories which aren't told, which are out there but maybe not recognized formally in some parts of like historical work. So then that's like offered me an opportunity to return to that way of working, I guess.
That makes sense. Definitely. Yeah. And I think importantly, we speak a lot about education here on this podcast, and you said you had a really great history teacher. And I think a lot of people, unfortunately, have had the complete opposite. And, you know, they're not involved in history today and they kind of pick it up later in life because it's kind of a necessity to kind of maybe understand your roots or your family's history or where you came from. But this good history teacher that you had, we're very thankful for, because now we have work, you know, coming out of scholars like yourself, which we need in society today, I think, definitely. So who or what, maybe, not sure, motivates you? Maybe it's that teacher, since you've just said that, but to study history, like what keeps you going in the field?
What keeps me going? I think if you've had to do like a big research project ever, and when you go to an archive or have to do an interview, and sometimes you find something or someone who you think was doing something amazing or like changes what you think about a period, and those sort of like mini eureka moments, they're it's like a little like adrenaline rush. And I think sometimes feeling like you're doing something useful, because a lot of time in history you think, oh well, what's the point, it's not a STEM subject, or that's what people sometimes say.
Course.
But I guess those moments make you think like you're doing something really invaluable. And I guess in the last few months, there's so much attention on what a history curriculum should be in schools.
Absolutely.
And like the importance that activists and normal citizens, normal school kids think about wanting to like dictate what their curriculum, have a say in what they want to know. Yeah. I think that those, seeing that on like a national scale almost every day on the news or on discussion programs on the radio, that's given me like a little motivation to think, oh, it's worthwhile carrying on in this field.
Definitely. It has been, I think, at the forefront of so many conversations, especially following Black Lives Matter, but then now with, you know, the statues being returned to Nigeria, and so many different parts of history are coming to the forefront of like national conversation, which is wonderful, I guess, for us. It kind of puts us, gives us a job to do, and as you said, makes us feel quite worthwhile, definitely. And if you could research any historical time period or area outside of what you do and your expertise, what would you do? Where would you go? What country or time or?
I would go to Mauritian history in the colonial period between the French and the British handover, because during that period, I think it's just a really confusing period of Mauritian history, and there are questions about slavery, indenture, and crossovers and living together communities, that it's, I think, there are lots of people working on it. It's not under-researched, but I would love to know more about it. I think especially, you know, my interest is about like the afterlife of empire, and those, I think this is a part of empire I would love to research more fully if I had the resources to go stay in Mauritius, definitely, and do it from there. But
And you'd be in Mauritius in the sun.
Exactly.
In the cold. Oh, that would be fantastic. Yeah, definitely. I don't think we think too much about the kind of crossover periods of different European colonizers taking over and switching. And a lot of countries, especially in the Caribbean as well, had that switch over. You know, Jamaica went from the Spanish to the British after a war. and so on and so forth. So yeah, definitely. I've never even thought about that as a field to kind of get into, but yeah, definitely. If you have the chance, you should do that for sure. And my final question in this little segment, if you weren't studying history at PhD level, you weren't doing all of this, what would you be doing?
So I'm not allowed to say teaching history at school or anything like that.
No history. It doesn't exist.
No history. I'd be doing something really boring then.
I thought you'd say fencing.
I'll say fencing professionally. I'll say that.
You don't have to.
No, that's true. I sort of feel like I do that already though. So I feel that's also cheating. But I'll say fencing is the thing. Coaching fair fencing enough. At the very least. Then.
I think by your hesitancy to answer, we know that you would be doing something historical. You have to be. Yeah. If you weren't this, it would be a history teacher. So yeah, we understand the passion, I think, definitely.
It's like whenever a footballer gets asked, what would you be if you weren't a footballer? And they say like a PE teacher. I just did the equivalent of that.
So we're going to think about your research and you're going to teach us and teach me, because as much as I know, you know, many little things around immigration, empire, Windrush mainly, I think your research is something, it's like a blind spot for me. It's like, you know, some of the things you think about and you look at in depth will come up in the periphery of my own research or my own reading, but I never kind of get to delve into them. So I am really excited to kind of hear, you know, about your research. So I guess thinking about migration, you look at obviously South Asian communities. If you want to just talk us through kind of where your research in regards to migration kind of started and or where it is now in regards to this kind of idea of like migration and empire.
So my entry point in my PhD and also in my master's was to talk about Southall, which is a part of West London, which at the time was most known for being home to a large Punjabi community. So from Punjab region of India, which is an area that was really affected by partition. And I suppose the first thing to say, if we're talking about like empire and how it impacts migration, is for people who come over from Punjab to Southall, there is sort of an urban myth that accompanies their migration, which is that there was a factory in West London which someone had served alongside Punjabi soldiers in the war.
Yeah.
And the urban myth in Southall, which actually has quite a lot of truth to it, was he was so impressed by the valor and strength of Punjabi soldiers that when he was in charge of a factory in West London, he got some people to come over and then sort of chain migration people, encouraging people from Punjab to come over. And I entered that as that sort of, that little sort of historical reasoning, and started to think about what sort of the legacy of a Second World War, what it meant to be in sort of the imperial forces of Britain, and why in the 60s and 70s, teenagers are justifying their presence in Southall in Britain by saying, well, it's because Sikhs fought in the Second World War. We were part of the British Empire. And even through the 70s, there's evidence of people who came to Southall when they're 8 years old, and they still justify their presence by saying, oh, my great-grandfather fought for the British.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that as sort of like an imperial connection, that like, I'm sure you feel it with Windrush, is sometimes the popular narrative is it's almost like that moment of first contact where a bunch of people in Britain meet these strange, dark strangers, and everything changes. It's like E.T. sort of, they meet for the first time.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I was trying to find this tale about Punjabi men predominantly serving and then coming over to Britain. And then as the case, as I'm sure in your research as well, that the Immigration Acts start changing and they start incentivizing people to rush over in 1961. Before there's a sort of an assumed ban coming in for immigration.
Of course. Yeah.
So suddenly the makeup of this migrant community completely changes.
Yeah.
You have women, dependents, children, and sort of I don't want to say stresses, but the requirements of the local authority, the state. Yeah. For that population changes. So we have really controversial things like busing in Southall, where and it happened in Birmingham as well. Where South Orley was South Asian, but also some Caribbean kids who were bused to schools nearly 10 miles away, some as far as Watford, to from West London, and to effectively be taught separately from white British children because parents didn't want them taught in the same classes. And then I suppose I talk about migration by starting from like a really fixed geographical point, Southall. And I understand that there are lots of people that perhaps think about diasporas more broadly. So the Punjabi diaspora in Britain or Punjabi diaspora globally. And my approach in my work has been to say, let's pick a part of London and work backwards from there and figure out what are the currents bringing people here to Southall. And I guess one point I would probably raise is that myth, that story about Punjabi soldiers serving alongside the British and then following a captain who was working in Southall to this factory in West London. It seems half true because there was someone who had served in British India, and he did initially start recruiting Punjabi men. But there were so many other reasons that they may have ended up there. The main one probably is partition, that the Punjab is a really volatile region, and there's a huge amount of, I think it's maybe the biggest mass migration in history when India and Pakistan get partitioned and people rush across the border. People sort of deracinated from where they grew up, from their land. So once you're removed from your from where you grew up, from your homeland in maybe one side of the border, to suddenly move to another country maybe has less of a, it's less scary, it's less daunting.
Yeah, definitely.
I think when you start from Southall and you try and work backwards along that sort of that path of migration, empire is really important. It's almost impossible to understand that without thinking about those, the end of empire, but also the imperial experience. So, for example, the war. And I guess that maybe one big thing I thought of, especially when we've gone through Brexit and all these quite like fraught confrontations recently, is one accusation that has sort of been thrown back at people is that it's like imperial nostalgia. That Brexit is a manifestation of imperial nostalgia and people can't get over empire. And that might be true, but I think it's worth saying that it's not only the sort of Brexiteers who frame their lives via empire or sort of imperial amnesia, that for, I hope it doesn't sound too controversial, but like for Punjabi migrants in Southall, like it's really hard to understand why you're in Southall, if you're in the 70s, without explaining it with reference to the empire, it frames your life in Britain and even like your possibilities and how you're treated by the police, by the state, by your health care outcomes, your education, everything. And it's understood in those terms.
Definitely. No, you have, definitely brought up a lot of things to think about, but just pulling up on your kind of point of this. You mentioned end of empire. And I think it's an interesting way of phrasing it. I don't know if you're, would you say empire ended, I guess, in a sense of, you know, now that we have this migration to Southall specifically, let's think about that. How do you feel it being framed as an end of empire? And why do you frame it, I guess, as ending of empire?
I think on one level it is like the ending of formal empire. So the structures that we recognize politically of one country having sort of jurisdiction or ruling over another, those come to an end because they're no longer practical, morally acceptable, or economic after the Second World War for any number of reasons. And I think that there's I think I get what you're getting at, that today I could go into newspapers and read about there needs to decolonize something or other, as if empire still hasn't ended or some aspects of it haven't ended. And I guess that it's historically, it's important to mark a different period.
Definitely.
But there is something, while these imperial connections are historic, they go back over 100 years, this is like a new phase of the relationship. And it's something new in Britain that the period both you and I concentrate on, a visible difference really matters in Britain.
Definitely.
In a way that would seem extremely strange to us now. But those sort of interactions, they are important and they are new. And I think maybe end of empire is strange, because if you ask someone to pick a fixed date, when did empire end? It's a fool's errand. You're not going to be able to do that. But I think we can talk about an extended period of time, maybe from the end of the Second World War to, I guess, 1968, 1971, that period where Britain is slowly getting rid of its empire. And I guess the thing, I think we could even think and comparatively a bit. So the end of empire in France is a really dramatic event. Like the Algerian War nearly brings, the Algerian War ends a government in France. It creates a huge domestic crisis.
Absolutely.
Britain doesn't necessarily have a defined moment like that. And I think the sort of stereotypical response, it ended with a whimper, not a bang.
Yes.
that can, I don't know if it's right to say there's truth in that, but at least that's the way it's popularly portrayed.
Like
this was silently phased out, and then there was this sudden new demographic change in Britain. But I understand that at some point, like, the empire is not, it's not one thing. It's fluid. And I think especially with the populations, the people of color, the sorts of groups I study, a lot of it is about reaching back to that heritage and trying to reshape it to your advantage, whether it's as an activist or whether it's to demand change. But it's not necessarily to be trapped into it as something that never goes away.
Definitely. No, that makes sense, Defo. I just wondered, you know, what your kind of definition of that was, because it isn't, I think, a very interesting term and can be unpacked quite a lot for sure. Thinking about Southall then, and this region in, you know, West London, and I guess in a way, I think you frame it quite interestingly, because as you said, you start from Southall and you track that backwards. Whereas I think for me, when I look at especially Windrush, I kind of look at the Caribbean and then I work forwards to, you know, whether that be Handsworth or Brixton or some other part of the United Kingdom. So should we talk about Southall? What was the situation? What was happening in Southall? Sound like you're a reporter, and so over to you. What was happening in Southall in the 1970s and 80s? That kind of, I guess, what was the reason for, you know, the Southall Black Sisters? Why did they have to form, and, you know, why was it the case that this was needed in Southall at this moment?
So I think the starting point for that is to say that Southall is a really radical black space in the 1970s. And I know that you've done previous podcasts about sort of political blackness. And this is the period when that term black has a really expansive definition. And in this historical moment, it means a lot for many groups, especially groups, sort of younger adults, sort of adolescents. They reach across to this idea of being made black in Britain, being black in Britain. And this is a description of your life in Britain in relation to empire, racism, capitalism as well. And I guess the Southall Black Sisters are a radical black feminist group. They are a black feminist collective, as they describe themselves in this period. And they are, I would go so far to say, is they are only possible in a place like Southall, where a majority South Asian community is able to describe themselves as black and say and understand themselves in those terms. And what leads to that sort of realization is sort of quite, it's like a confluence of factors. So you have the men who initially come to work in Southall, they are put in the worst jobs. I think one guy describes it as they're put in all the smelly jobs. So they're in factories, they're working insane shift patterns. their ramifications for their health in the sort of heavy industry they're working with.
Definitely.
Then when you start having sort of a populated demographics changing, busing is another instance of sort of unequal treatment in Southall, depending on the color of your skin. And that's not just for the children, it's also a sense of unfairness for the parents.
Definitely.
The police start being, I guess, there's quite like vigorous, quite nasty policing in Southall that creates a lot of racist policing. There are instances between the police and citizens and residents of Southall which are violent, they're aggressive, and they're racist. And this is something that the reports I use come from the Runnymede Trust, I think one report is written by Deepak Nandi, who is a Marxist academic whose daughter is now the Shadow Foreign Secretary, Lisa Nandi. So those sort of experience in Southall start rolling together, and there's perhaps one moment that galvanizes it. And there's in 1976, there's a murder by National Front, by a gang of National Front members, thugs, whatever, who murder Gurdip Singh Chagar, who's an 18-year-old student in Southall. Yeah. And over the next few days, a lot of the sort of community representation who invariably tend to be Punjabi men of a certain age who have sort of are repackaging politics from India, so trade union politics, into community representation.
Yeah.
And young people in Southall don't want these people to speak on their behalf. They don't accept, you know, we want calm on behalf of the community. We need good race relations. It's sort of a tipping point. And from that moment, you get organizations like the Southall Youth Movement, it describes itself as being the Southall youth movement, not the Asian youth movement, for example, because they're trying to reach across to Afro-Caribbeans who live in Southall as well. Probably the most famous is Misty and Roots, the reggae band. They make a song about the Southall riots, and they are connected with the Southall youth movement at this time.
Yeah.
And the symbol of the Southall youth movement is a clenched black fist. So they're reaching across to the symbols of black power. They're reaching across to ideas about black activism in the UK. And they are thinking about that those politics. So the Southall youth movement have reading groups where they read Frantz Fanon, who wrote The Wretched of the Earth, which is a really radical text about empire and colonialism. And why the Southall Black Sisters emerge from this moment is the Southall Youth Movement is quite a macho organization. It views anti-racism as street fights with a national front. So these guys would travel in the 70s to other neighborhoods nearby and go and find some national front thugs and try and get into a fist fight, or probably worse. And this is like a recurring theme in that period of Southall, but it's a really macho expression of anti-racism. And then you hit 1979, and you have the Southall riots. And just like as a sort of a tangent, is that the Southall riots are, when I've been reading the work of Paul Gilroy and Stuart Hall, and from 1981 to 1984, you have St. Paul's, Brixton, Handsworth, you have Moss Side as well. You have lots of riots in urban Britain. But it's really easy to forget Southall. And in fact, I was reading Stuart Hall's reflections on the Macpherson inquiry. And he doesn't mention Southall in that sort of that time frame. And, you know, there are perhaps reasons. It could be a simple oversight. He might think it's not important. But I think sometimes to think of South Asians as being like a radical black collective in this period, it's I think it's being lost historically. Agree. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's definitely.
Really yeah.
But no, I think it's a really important point to pull up, because I think when I hear that list of kind of those early 80s riots, Southall isn't in them. You know, it's Moss Side, it's Brixton, it's Handsworth, it's Toxic, it's Tottenham. And I think it's very easy to kind of push out the South Asian experience because it doesn't necessarily cleanly fit into this Windrush narrative that we have so neatly packaged up, I think, in some parts of society. And I definitely think it needs to be brought back, because you can't separate out Asian people out of the struggle, the anti-racist struggle in Britain in those early days. It's just in regards to women as well. We had OAD, you know, the Organization of Women for of People of African and Asian Descent. You know, that was a culminative movement, and it didn't just start as the mix. It was just for African descent. And then we had women coming from Kenya and Uganda, Asian women who said, well, we're coming from Africa. You know, where's the movement and the space for us? And I guess you have Southall Black Sisters as well. And thinking about what they ended up then fighting against with anti-racism, but then also stuff like domestic violence within, you know, their own communities, and religious fundamentalism and other things in that sense, I think to kind of X them off of the narrative of blackness, because we've moved on from political blackness, or we don't use that anymore. We don't use terms like, well, BAME. You know, we've got people of colour. We've got these amalgamations of non-white people. And I guess as black people, we don't want to feel othered in British society, which I think is constantly done. But by doing this kind of separation, we forget about the South Asian stories. And it's like cutting out, you know, an arm from a body of anti-racism, because it is definitely part of it. So.
No, I agree. I think just quickly, it's like you like Indo-Caribbeans, like Roy Soir, like an Indo-Guyanese guy who is like really important for the British Black Panthers. You have when Malcolm X comes to Smethwick, he's invited by the Indian Workers Association. I think it's Doshi is this the guy's name. Yep.
Yeah.
Him and his wife invite Malcolm X to Britain to Smethwick. So
Birmingham is a very Asian area to this day, and Smethwick especially. So, you can't separate them out at all.
Yeah, and so this exactly, like your point, is one of the reasons I think Southall is important for British history. And actually, that's the point of my PhD. If it wasn't important, I wouldn't be able to do it. But but it's like, Southall, it makes us maybe reassess what we think about race and ethnicity, and how, in my opinion, in my research, what comes up is what race is, or what it can be as a political tool. Mm-hmm. I think something like the Southall Black Sisters, they are a group that look at race and say, how do we bend the edges of this to our advantage so we can make a political platform which has the biggest chance of achieving our aims, which is, in the case of Southall Black Sisters, to improve the lives and opportunities for women of color living in Britain. Right? Like, It's pretty clear. And actually, some of their campaigns go beyond Britain as well. I guess for Southall Black Sisters, like, just to think about them, like when you start talking about OAD, so the Southall Black Sisters, they go to speak to Stella Dadzi. They are in interaction with these groups. They take notes, and they have all their memos are stored at the Black Cultural Archives in Brixton. And they're having these conversations about, how are we going to represent South Asian and Afro-Caribbean women? Can we do this? And I guess at the time, they view the decision to represent both African, Caribbean, and South Asian women as a political decision. So not something that is perhaps based in the practical daily business of running a woman's refuge, but something that would be important politically. But this is a comment on the forces they see oppressing women of color in Britain. So that is state racism, police racism. It's also patriarchal forces in their community, often religion, because they are a secular organization, immigration laws. I think the list goes on. And also capitalism. It has to be said that they are a socialist They have people who are socialists in their group, and they use this analysis to think about the ways that women of color are sort of at the bottom of the heap sometimes.
Definitely.
And I guess perhaps the most famous, as we could spend all day talking about their various campaigns, and we do have a time limit, but their most famous campaign, which was actually turned into a movie with an Indian actress called Ishwarya Rai.
Okay.
It was called Provoked, and it was about the case of Kiranjit Ahluwalia, who was a It was a South Asian woman who killed her husband in self-defense.
Yes.
After he had abused her physically, yes. was violent towards her. And she was initially jailed for, I think it was murder or something along those lines. And the South All Black Sisters launched this huge campaign. I think they got Princess Diana involved as well to free her. And they eventually ended up with...
Now, you might be thinking, what happened in the case of Kiranjit Ahluwalia? And you might be thinking, why has this episode come to an end? Well, I'm sorry to say we are having a two-part episode this week, because when I came to edit this podcast, I realized there was just so much information in each part of this episode and so many facts. You know, we've talked about the Punjab, the end of empire, Southall, different ways to fight anti-racism, fights with the National Front and the kind of masculine front of this anti-racist work, the Southall riots, the Southall Black Sisters, OAD, and the case of Kiranjit Ahluwalia. And so I didn't want to overload any single episode. And I think Satya has given us so much food for thought in terms of this one episode in thinking of, you know, South Asians and what that means in regards to anti-racism in Britain. And so we will be back next week with part two, where we will be thinking more about Southall as a region, anti-racist struggles in the context of Black women, Asian women, and people from, you know, different continents that were all fighting essentially the same fight against the British state and also overt racism in this country. And so, yeah, thank you so much to Satya, who has been a fantastic guest. We've learned so much, and we, you know, will be seeing him again next week. So please do tune in, follow us on our social medias and on our podcast platforms, and have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.